Hello, my name is Elder Price, and I would like to share with you the most amazing book. Hello, my name is Elder Grant. It's a book about America a long, long time ago. It has so many awesome parts, you simply won't believe how much this book can change your life.
Hello, my name is Elder Green. I would like to share with you this book of Jesus Christ.
Hello, my name is Elder Young.
Hello,
did you know that Jesus lived here in the USA?
You can read all about it now.
Hello,
in this nifty book, it's free, no, you don't have to pay.
Hello,
hello, my name is Elder Smith, and can I leave this book with you for you to just peruse?
Hello,
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 I'll just leave it here. It has a lot of information you can really use.
Hello,
hi,
my name is
Jesus Christ.
You have a lovely home.
Hello,
it's an amazing book.
Bonjour,
hola,
ni hao,
me llamo Elder White.
Are these your kids?
This book gives you the secret to eternal life.
Sound good?
Eternal life
with Jesus Christ
is super fun.
Hello,
ding dong.
And if you let us in, we'll show you how it can be done.
No thanks.
You're sure? Oh, well,
that's fine.
Goodbye.
Have fun in hell.
Hey now,
you simply won't believe how much this book will change your life. Will change your mind.
Change your life.
This book will change your life.
Hello, would you like to change religions? I have a free book written by Jesus.
No, no, Elder Cunningham. That's not how we do it. You're making things up again. Just stick to the approved dialogue.
Oh, well, hey there, everybody. This is Brett, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's July 30th, 2012. I almost never do this, but today on the show, a supplemental installment, I'm going to repost a recent episode of Complete Liberty Podcast, Wes Bertrand's show. You may or may not know this, depending on how new you are to School Sucks, that I used to be a pretty regular co-host on Complete Liberty Podcast. In fact, I just finished uploading every episode of the show that I've ever been on to the new website. I think it was something like 25 episodes, maybe. So if you're unfamiliar with that, it was the first podcast I was ever on back at the end of 2008. I did an education series with Wes. We also did series on nonviolent communication, intellectual property, and a variety of unrelated shows in between. So I hope that once we launch the new site, you will check that out. But because I'm on the show relatively frequently, I don't usually repost those episodes here, but I hadn't been on the show in over a year, and I really enjoyed the conversation that we had last week. It was Wes, Jeremy Franzen, who has a site called Internet Business Mastery. He's helped me out with some suggestions in the past. In fact, the bonus content section that I've been working on for the last couple weeks, that was his idea. So how about that? You'll get a look at that soon. If you're a subscriber, you can learn how to do that at schoolsucksproject.com/support, or go right to our Podomatic page at schoolsucks.podomatic.com, and you can see how to sign up for $6 a month or more if you like. Yeah, I'm not going to stop you if you want to give more. And once we launch that new site, which we are getting there, you can get access to a bunch of additional content, archive shows, videos, bonus shows, pre-shows from the live show, our After School Sucks special, and even some show planning sessions. There's also going to be a section called School Sucks Home Movies. Be some fun stuff in there. And many, many hours of unreleased live shows. You might remember that we were filling in for Gardner on his Liberty Conspiracy show earlier this year. And he, at the time, was not reposting those as podcasts. So I have so many hours of recorded live stuff that has never been released. And I'm guessing never been heard by almost everybody. So that is in there as well. You can hear us learn to do live radio. I guess you can hear us learn to do live radio every Thursday at 10 p.m. on LRN or at schoolsucksproject.com/live. So Wes had been doing a series on religion, and he asked Jeremy and me to join him for the final episode of this series. And Jeremy was raised a Mormon, so that was interesting. But one of the things that I also thought made this relevant for my podcast is we spend a lot of time talking about the religion of the state, and we learn about that in a little church called Public School. So we do devote a fair amount of time to this discussion to talking about education versus schooling. Most of us had schooling first, and then education later on our own. And this is a long one. I think the show is over 2 hours. So I hope you enjoy this. If you have not been listening to Complete Liberty Podcast, I hope this is a good introduction for you, and I hope you'll check out the show in the future. There's going to be a couple new things coming this week. We have the live show from last Thursday. Kate Baker joined me. We wound up debating most of the time, which was some polite disagreements. It was fun. And I also want to do a little show about No Child Left Behind. Oh, God. All right. So that's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care.
The Book of Mormon. Mormon. Hello!
Welcome to episode 168 of the Complete Liberty Podcast. This is Wes, coming to you from Idaho, and I have two guests on the show. This is our final in the roundtable series on religion. I have Brett in New Hampshire. Hey, Brett.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well. Great to have you on the show again. It's been a while.
It has been a while. It's great to be back.
Yeah, excellent. We had Daniel on a while back, too, just a few shows ago, because he threw in his stories about his religious upbringing, which was pretty substantial.
Oh, yeah, that is quite a story.
Yeah, he freed himself from the military matrix and the religious one.
Oh, and quite an escape, I was going to say, too, if you consider everything that he was involved in, yeah.
Yeah, and of course we've got Jeremy on the line in Salt Lake City. Hey, Jeremy.
Hey, Wes and Brett, how are you doing?
Great, yeah, you've not been on the show before, but it's great to have you on this time. Talking about religion, because I know, you know, we've been friends since we met each other in San Diego. Gosh, what was it, 4 years ago?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. We were both down there and went our separate ways, but have kept in touch. And I know that you grew up in the Salt Lake City area, so you're pretty familiar with religiosity, right?
Oh, yeah. I was raised Mormon.
Uh-huh.
So I at least pretty well know that system.
Yeah. How many people do you think that are raised Mormon end up freeing themselves from that?
Wow, it has to be really, really tiny. Only the people that I know seem to have gotten out of it. I don't know if I gravitate towards them or I'm just so into talking about the escape that it's a tiny little helper with them escaping. But yeah, most people I know, I mean, I live in a circle. And
a celestial circle, mind you.
Yeah, that's what they call it, which is one of the levels of heaven in the Mormon heaven. And yeah, I've got a bishop living next to me, a stake president, all of these high level, Mormon officials live in this little circle that I live in. And I'm the only outsider, although they keep trying to get me to go to their little breakfasts and stuff and try and bring me back into the fold. I think it's a blemish on the celestial circle to have a non-believer, but.
Well, did they know for certain that you're a non-believer?
Yeah, the first moment, the first person that lives across the street, he came over to say hello. He let me know the times for church.
Oh,
and
wow.
I said, oh yeah, I don't go to church. I tried to, be somewhat respectful in the beginning. And he was like, oh, well, we've got a breakfast you can come to. And, trying to get me back in, they just see it more as a challenge than anything else.
Yeah, we went to an atheist meetup group there in Salt Lake, and we ended up talking about, or the group started talking about this thing of being on the list.
Yeah.
Right? You're on this list once you're in the church?
Yeah, the church rolls, they call it, I guess. Once you're born into it or come into it in any way, you stay on the list unless you get either excommunicated or there's another formal term that I can't remember right now that makes it so you're off the main list and on kind of a unsubscribe list is what I call it now. But
and it's really hard to get off the list, isn't it? What do you have to do to get off that list?
Yeah, I went through a procedure of excommunication to supposedly get off the list. Now, I haven't received anything from them since that happened. Oh, wow. Gosh. almost 20 years ago. So maybe I'm on the unsubscribe of the unsubscribe. I mean, maybe I've made it off. I doubt I'm too far off the list, but at least they haven't contacted me since.
Yeah.
But it was a process. I had to go through a whole process just for them to take my name off the list.
Did it include showing that you've taken the blasphemy challenge?
Yeah, I mean, that's what started the process of getting off the list was the blasphemy challenge, for sure.
I was going to ask what the grounds were for excommunication from the Mormon Church.
Yeah, it was 20 years ago. It was all based on, I talked through not only just the logic of there not being a God, you know, back then I was really heavily into it, to, you know, the inconsistencies of how the Mormon Church works in reality, and how, you know, God certainly says things only when the state starts attacking them. You know, suddenly black people can hold the priesthood when they're going to get their tax status taken away. You know, and I mentioned a lot of these little things that they all coincide exactly with, you know, they actually wouldn't allow African-American people or any people of any color to be a priesthood holder until right after the United States, I guess, cracked down on them and said, you'll lose your tax status if you keep this up. And then the prophet, like the month later, it was really quickly after this, had a revelation from God that all men, not women, still women don't get to have the priesthood, but all men can now hold the priesthood.
Yes.
Well, that's cool that you guys had a living prophet. Like, I was raised Roman Catholic. All our prophets were gone.
Yeah, I guess there's that at least.
Yes. Update right. From the prophet. Weekly updates.
Yep. He's looking into a hat, looking at a magic rock.
Well, it's probably just coincidental that they changed that policy at that time, right? I mean, politics.
Surely, yes.
Purely coincidental.
And there's several things like that that happened whenever they get their tax status gets threatened. God seems to speak to the prophet then, and usually only then.
Yeah, and so they kind of swear off of caffeine, alcohol, those kinds of things that do damage to the body, right?
On paper. You know, I've got a friend that is we call him a closeted atheist. His entire family and every human being he knows except me is Mormon. His kids were raised Mormon. Everybody's Mormon. So he sort of still is involved in the Mormon Church, but on the side, he researches all the actual documents and what really happened and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And one of the things that he said to me recently is the amount of people that are signing up to be Mormon has gone down so drastically. And he thinks, of course, it's because of the internet and, you know, being able to have access to other opinions and even the truth, I guess we could say. But he says that they've been really relaxing a lot of their policies to try and get the young kids back. And so there's a lot of things like that that's happening. Basically, it's just a marketing shift or a PR shift to try and keep the kids so that they can get those next generations.
I wonder if they've learned from the other older religions, like, because it seems from what you're describing, Jeremy, that there's a considerable degree of fluidity here with some of the doctrine. And, you know, I mean, just going back to Catholicism, how they had to be dragged kicking and screaming, you know, into modern times, well, or, you know, even within a couple hundred years of modern times, and how that hurt the followership of the church. And I mean, going back to the Age of Reason, the Enlightenment, all of that. So I wonder if they're learning from history a little bit.
Yeah, they would have to be. I mean, they run it as a business. I mean, it's run the Catholic Church has that as well. But
sure.
I think they're actually – I think they were rated – the last time I read about this, they were rated like second behind the Catholic Church financially as far as their holdings and this kind of thing. And I think they're – you know, they're probably – I mean, obviously, this is just – what I think about it, but I think they're just following as much as they can, and they probably feel they're more advanced about some things as far as business goes, than the Catholic Church. But I definitely think they pay attention to that. I mean, why wouldn't you? I mean, if you're doing it, this is a business, and you've got marketing, which they all have that, then watching other businesses that have done really well, watching them and following them and trying to emulate that would be the smart way to do it.
Right.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of religions are doing that. A lot of denominations are, you know, there's this, The Rock is the name of a church. I guess it's kind of a universal name for these really fun and exciting ways to promote the gospel and stuff for the youth.
Yeah, he's also in a lot of good movies, so that's cool.
He is. Yes, he's got that going for him.
And not so good movies. So. And he's got a church, so that's awesome.
But speaking of the marketing that the Mormon religion does, there's the door-to-door, the missionaries, right? That's a huge aspect of the proselytizing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. My business partner was raised Mormon as well, and he went on a mission.
A mission from God.
Yep, and he went to France, and apparently they don't allow you to go door to door, so he had, you know, they had to find other ways to meet people and become a part of the community. But he did that for 2 years, and you know, we talked all about that. I've had almost every one of my friends actually went on a mission. I actually got out of the church before they could snatch me up on a mission. But yeah, it's interesting. It's very much about relationship marketing is what I would call it. Uh-huh. They come, they don't talk much about the religion at first. They, you know, become a part of your life and then slowly but surely start adding it. In the same way as the Scientology people don't tell you about Xenu until you're, you know, $100,000 into it.
Yeah.
You don't want to lead with that. Although I did tell Jason's, my business partner, I said, you know, one part of the Mormon religion is that you can become a god. And I said, you know, had you guys came to my door and led with that, maybe I would have listened. Because he doesn't want to be a god, right?
Like, exactly.
Lead with that. You know, don't tell me about all this other stuff. I don't care.
Yeah. Nothing like the power of omnipotence and omniscience and infallibility. You know,
yeah,
these, these qualities. Omnipresence, that's another one. You can be all places at all times.
Yeah.
And sure. What else? Omnibenevolent. But then the problem of evil arises, and there's all kinds of dialogues and apologetics about that issue, right?
Yeah, and if you knew something was going to happen, how would you be mad about it?
Exactly. Why would you condemn the very thing that you created, supposedly humanity, to, you know, sin, a sinful nature, by nature? You've created an organism by nature that's supposedly sinful and must now worship you. I mean, it really sounds like, I mean, this sort of God has an inferiority complex, huh?
Yeah, something. There's so many inconsistencies, it's hard to, you know, think about one specific one. They're all so crazy.
I've touched on some of those, but yeah, when you get inside that can of worms, it's like there's no end to the worms. It's just... But have you guys seen that video that's titled Door-to-Door Atheists Bother Mormons?
No, I haven't.
I did see, I was going through our show prep, and I did see this... this British man, maybe I saw the first couple minutes of it.
Yes, he's pretty crass with his explication of it, but it's nonetheless pretty hilarious because I think they go to Salt Lake City and they dress up like the Mormons do in the you know, the white shirts with the ties and the bicycles and all that, and they, I don't know what book, oh, I think they have Origin of Species instead of the Book of Mormon.
Right.
Yeah, so they end up knocking on doors and stuff, and needless to say, they did not get received very well by most folks.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Yeah.
Especially in Utah.
Yeah. So why do you suppose that religion gets a pass for so many things in the culture that are harmful to not only adults, but children especially? I mean, there was an article on alternet.org titled, "Why Does Religion Always Get a Free Ride? We try to persuade people out of almost every kind of idea there is. Why should religion be the exception?" Now, I'm not sure how that author, what that author is responding to. Greta Christina, she also has an atheistic blog. But maybe she's experienced a lot of this blowback or the antagonism towards trying to deliver the truth, the actual truth based on objective reality to people.
Oh, I think in our time, it has a lot to do with political correctness, because I think if you look at most of history, the number one target on most people's heads was their religion. You know, maybe save for Christianity in Europe and the United States for the last couple hundred years. But, I mean, religion, I think, is probably the number one reason for persecution historically, and certainly close to the top of the list.
Mm-hmm.
So, also, I would say, consider the source. You know, Alternet is a relatively liberal website, and most criticisms coming from the left on religion are directed at conservatives.
Yeah.
Because I think when we maybe change from the word religion to mysticism, liberalism and progressivism certainly has plenty of their own issues. I think for people who extol the virtues of science so much, when it comes to economics, they should really check out math, you know, like addition and subtraction. So I think that part of this raising of questions about religion really in the last couple of decades has been more from the left and directed at the conservatives.
Yeah, there is a definite perspective of this right-left paradigm that is so common. It's almost like the two groups are designed systematically to antagonize each other. And, you know, the people that are claiming to be conservative and religious believe that they have an objective view of morality, whereas the liberal progressives view that as being dogmatic, you know, and they want a more relativistic, subjectivist interpretation of things. So it's like that is just an ongoing, never-ending sort of discrepancy between the two. And, of course, none of them seem to step outside of that paradigm and look at things in a logical way. You know, Brett and I did a show recently for your podcast, School Sucks, about the nature of logic and how it's about really defining your terms and whatever the concept is, chasing it back to reality, finding to what in reality does this concept refer. And a lot of the religious stuff is not based in reality. So that kind of shows its non-objectivity.
Mm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, this article is incredibly long. It's like 5 pages, but she discusses a lot about how there's so much debate in our culture about all kinds of different subjects and so forth, but religion tends to always be that sort of respected idol, if you will, or ideology that's about personal beliefs, right? So it's not wise to challenge those things because people have all their different reasons for having those beliefs. And I think that's why a lot of people are turned off by the new atheists, you know, Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins, and, you know, the polemical writers railing against religion and its harm to people and promoting atheism.
Well, it's a territory that I think a lot of people don't want to tread into either, because it's such a deeply emotional topic for so many people, especially when they get up in years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this kind of enters into the realm of cognitive biases as well. Like, the longer you've held a belief, the more violently you're going to cling to it, you know? So I think that these, we're told, don't talk about religion and politics in polite company. And my joke has always been, well, that's because if we actually talked about these things, we'd realize they're both BS.
Yeah.
But I think that these are subjects that are incredibly inflammatory. And because people have accepted them for so long, it is very difficult to look at those beliefs in an objective fashion at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that maybe it's just a matter of convenience. Like, people don't want to, especially when there's such a liability for it in the media. You know, like, if you say the wrong thing about somebody's religion, you could land yourself in a lot of trouble.
Yeah. And a lot of it has to do with how people were indoctrinated early on, too, because there's a lot of fear of challenging these memes when it relates directly to the family and those emotional ties to people in your life that are still believers, you know? So, Jeremy, did any of the family members that were Mormon escape that besides you?
My brother and sister did, but that was just, I think, heavy influence for me.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, the rest of my family still is.
Yeah. And so what enabled you to see past the fears of losing the connections, perhaps, in search of the truth? You know, like, at all costs, no matter what the consequences are, I'm going to look at reality in a clear way.
Wow, that's a good question. I guess because in the society I live in, the Mormon thing, once I was about 14 when I started saying I'm no longer Mormon, or I just don't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just the way the culture was. Everybody's Mormon, but all my Mormon friends were the ones, you know, there were a couple of friends that were different religions, but my Mormon friends were like the ones that were drinking and trying drugs, but they still went to church, you know, and this kind of thing. And there was this like break off where I started just thinking, oh, well, look at all these, you know, this hypocrisy, and you know, I've got this friend who's saying, oh, you need to come back to the church, and then he's trying to get me to try pot the next day. Do you know what I mean? And I'm like going, yeah, that might be just a little stronger than caffeine. I'm not sure because I hadn't tried it, but do you know what I mean?
It's holy pot.
Yeah, exactly. Somehow it's been blessed. But I just, because of my growing up around the hypocrisy, there was something about it that my friends at that age still kind of stuck by me. They didn't actually completely throw me out, so to speak, or kick me out of the group, because they, I'm sure, you know, at a subconscious level or whatever, they see their complete hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to believe in it, but they don't want to follow any of the rules, you know, which is, you know, a good teenage thing for some people anyway. But because I saw that, you know, they still, I don't know, kept in contact with me and I got to still be friends with them and they would just overlook it, so to speak. I just got used to that, so that when I finally did that to my family, I was like, I guess in my mind at that young age thought, oh, they're still going to, you know, be my family. Mm-hmm. Like, what are they going to kick me out? Say, you can't come to family events anymore. So it was literally just, you know, at that age and what went on in my life at that time that just made me go, I don't think this is going to be a problem. And you know, there are family members that I don't talk to now. And, you know, as I've been older, but not at that age, I think they all just thought they were going to bring me back. And they all tried, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it seems like it creates a lot of cognitive dissonance when someone strays from the flock in that way.
Yeah.
And so they have kind of two choices, either to be curious as to why you did and look at it logically. What are some of the rational reasons that you've chosen that way? Or
no adults did that, by the way.
No, unfortunately not.
You know, my brother and sister did, but yeah, no adults went, oh my gosh, wow, explain to me. They just went, no, you need to come back.
Yeah, you've turned over a stone that I might not have turned over. So let's look at this.
Yeah, no way.
Well, that was what I was going to ask, too. I mean, the younger people who observed what you were doing, Jeremy, did any of them follow suit?
I mean, later in their lives, some of them that I now know, again, through Facebook, of course, are no longer religious. I'm not sure what their process was, but when we were still kids and still under the direct authority of our parents, they were all considered themselves Mormon, at least that they told me, and they went to church and stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, even all through high school, when some kids were able to say, I'm not going anymore, but most of my friends still went.
Yeah, and they probably didn't engage in the whole process of excommunication either, right? Get off the list?
Yeah, I'm sure they're probably all on the list. It's a long process to get yourself off.
Kind of like the Scientology list, I guess.
Yeah, I wanted off so bad. I just thought it was so gross that somebody would keep me on a list I didn't want. I just didn't like that. In my early 20s, that just pissed me off. So that's why I went through it. But yeah, I don't think my friends are off.
Yeah, to speak to Brett's earlier point about the hostility and what religion has done traditionally or historically, this Christina wrote, and it's certainly true that throughout history, many attempts to, quote, persuade people out of their religion have resulted in persecution, or have provided the rationalization for it. Human beings have an ugly, bloody, terrible history of persecuting each other over religious differences. Anti-Catholic hostility in America in the late 19th and 20th centuries, anti-Muslim hostility in much of Europe today, the Crusades, the Holocaust, the list goes on. And religious persecution often goes hand in hand with classicism, jingoistic nationalism, ethnic hatreds, and racism, rendering it even uglier. A lot of people can only see persuading people out of religion in this context of persecution and are horrified by it. And while I disagree with their ultimate analysis, I can certainly understand their horror. But religion isn't the only idea whose adherents have historically been targeted with persecution. Political ideas certainly have been. To take an obvious example, look at communism. People who thought communism was a good idea had their lives utterly destroyed, even if they weren't actually trying to overthrow the government. Even if all they were doing was writing or creating art or gassing on in cafes with their friends, even if they weren't really communists, McCarthyism and other Red Scares destroyed the lives of countless people who were simply suspected of being communists. And like religious persecution, anti-communist fervor has often been closely tied to nationalism, ethnic hostilities, and more. Immigrants from Eastern Europe, for instance, were often feared and despised as dirty commies, with their political hostility becoming inextricably tangled with the xenophobic nationalism and each form of hostility feeding the other. Yeah, it's interesting that people in a communistic system are accusing other people of being communists. You know, we've talked about this on the show multiple times, that the essence of any government is communism. It is grouping people arbitrarily and coercively into a collective, and then extorting money from them and controlling their lives essentially for the, quote, common good.
Yeah, I think this also harkens back to what I was saying about the mystic progressives. Mm-hmm. There's always been this really strong correlative between communism and atheism, right? That communism is not a religion in itself. Mm-hmm. That just doesn't have, you know, the same kinds of gods as other religions do. But it's one of the talking points of religious types that you hear all the time that, you know, Stalin and Hitler. Now, Hitler is obviously more fascist than communist, but these people were atheists, and look where atheism went. But those were just religions where the state was God. I don't really think there's much distinction there.
No, there really isn't. There's not much difference.
Well, and it just seems like after so many years of debating the whole God thing and religion thing with people, really, it's all of that stuff is dancing around, does the God exist in the first place? So anytime, you know, like somebody starts going off on some of that kind of stuff, which I've argued 1,000 times that atheists are bad people or something like this. And no matter what, I mean, this is the weird thing of if you're trying to use logic and reason with somebody who's irrational on that subject, it's almost never a win. For either person, you know, I mean, we end up going our separate way. But, you know, I always tried to focus on, well, let's talk about the existence of this all-powerful, all-knowing being. And that's where I'm at now. Anytime it ever comes up, first of all, I don't define myself as an atheist anymore. And I only focus on that has been the way I've been doing it with, you know, my adult friends now. And it's I think it's been incredibly useful, at least with the people in my world, to just focus on the actual God issue before we start talking about, you know, what actual facts might be in the Quran or the Bible or something like that. And then it's just now we're on an offshoot, you know.
Yes.
That it doesn't matter. We're in the branches. I mean, we talk, you know.
in those branches. Oh, there's another leaf.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, let's get that leaf. I'm like, the hack the root is, okay, let's get to this whole idea of a God. But, and then the atheist thing, it's funny around where I live now. In my mind, even the term atheist almost means, oh, well, you're at least rational about that thing. Mm-hmm. But to other people, I mean, to religious people, they still really, really look down on it. The couple of times I've said atheist, I see the person's face just go, oh my God.
Yeah.
Both literally and figuratively. You know, so it's a weird thing. I just say, you know, I say, oh, I don't define myself as against some invisible sky ghost. You know, I'm not an a leprechaun either.
Mm-hmm.
I just use reason and empirical evidence. And I've been trying to do that stuff lately, to possibly lead to any sort of discussion in the rational realm.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just been something I've been trying lately. I mean, even with a neighbor, I've done that. And I had a theory here in Salt Lake. So my brother and my ex-wife actually had horrible examples of being shunned. I mean, even some simple things like generally when you move into a neighborhood, the Mormon neighbors will bring food and like say hello and say, hey, here's when church is. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's basically what they're trying to lead to is.
Here's the schedule.
Here's the schedule. I expect to see you there. And my brother, I'm usually a little more tactful about it, I guess. And my brother's just like, oh, I'm not Mormon. I never will be. And you won't see me at church. And his neighbor, it was an old couple. They came with a pie and they were handing it to him. When he said that, they pulled it away, turned around and never spoke to him for the 5 years he lived there.
Wow.
And then suddenly the other neighbors that had like came over and been talking completely, they wouldn't wave at him. And that's the weird thing. The Mormon thing, one of the essences of living in the Mormon community is how nice everyone is.
And how family-oriented they are, too, right?
Everything's about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I moved back from Los Angeles, where I lived for many years, I was used to not looking around at people, and I would see people making motions at me when I'm driving in my neighborhood, and it like after 2 weeks of just moving back in, I look over, and they're waving. I was like...
You're like, who, me? Looking behind you? Who are you pointing at?
Yeah, how odd is that? Somebody's waving to me, like just as a nice neighbor. And it very much is that until you give the A word or you make it absolutely known, you know, that none of their attempts are going to work. And then it switches off.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, at least that's just been my experience and the people I've known. Like the one neighbor doesn't talk to me anymore once I said, well, the closest thing to what I believe people call atheism. And like he used to come over and just chit chat. Now he doesn't. He's the bishop of the Mormon church. So, you know, other than family, I mean, out in the regular Mormon world, let's call it, you know, once you make it known that you're not going to buy into the delusion, it's kind of off for you. And there's certainly no questions back like, oh, why?
Yeah, I'm curious about that. What led you to those beliefs?
Yeah, no.
Now, you think that's something that the missionaries do, that they do the follow-up and they try to persist? Or do they just kind of go to the next door?
Well, the couple of times missionaries have come to my door, when I get right to it with them, they never come back, that pair of missionaries.
So missionaries have come to your door in Salt Lake City?
Oh, yeah.
That's very meta.
What is that interaction like, though? I mean, how does that go?
They generally say they talk about the relationship with Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'll talk about how I'm very strong with not having any interactions with invisible friends and this kind of stuff.
Including Jewish zombies, right?
Yeah. And I say all of that and not in a mean way. I just use it as normal conversation as I'm talking, as if, of course, it's this way is how I try and act. And it comes down to they stay incredibly nice. I've never had a, you know, Mormon team that come to the door. There's always the two of them. Ever be rude in any way, no matter what, you know, was said to them. Mm-hmm. And I try and stay generally respectful to people and just say the truth, you know. But they usually just go, oh, okay, well, thank you for your time is how it ends.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't like go, oh, well, why do you think that, you know, he's a Jewish zombie or what? You know, I mean, they don't ever ask any of that stuff. They are very much taught to keep things on point where they want it to go, or they just leave.
Yeah, to keep the conversation in a box where they're, you know, they have a certain comfort level, I would think. So if you have responses that are not part of the program, it's kind of like does not compute. And it's time to move on. And, you know, I was reading one of the articles, Wes, that you sent. And mm-hmm. This was actually, we're moving from Mormonism to the Westboro Baptist Church.
Yes, which is the most one of the most extreme denominations of Christianity, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And just on Jeremy's point there, one of the children of his Fred Phelps' 13 children, I think, who had freed himself and was doing an Ask Me Anything on, I think it was on Dig, you know, he said that my siblings were told by my father that, you know, homosexuality is the greatest sin and there is no way to come back from it. But what they do is they just identify sounds. You know, they're in a poor position to debate anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Because they just know sounds and then they have programmed sounds to respond to those sounds. And it sounds like what we're talking about is similar here. I used to live in Salem, Massachusetts, which is like one of the biggest Halloweens in the country. This is Salem, the witch town.
Sure,
Is interesting.
A fine history of burning witches at the stake.
Yeah, they kind of made a whole business town-wide out of probably one of the most horrible things that ever happened in colonial America.
Yeah.
But it's working for them. So Halloween is a big deal there, but all the weirdos come out on Halloween, and you always see these people with these big signs, and they have stages, and the sign is usually something that's like an illustration of Earth, like a modern Earth city burning. And then there's like a bridge that's actually a cross leading to the gates of heaven out of the fire. The end is near, this kind of thing. And I didn't find it to be particularly productive, but I found it to be interesting just to take an inquisitive approach. So I guess my next question regarding those interactions, Jeremy, is like, is there any questions coming from you towards them? And what would the response be, if so?
Well, when I was younger, and I would talk to any sort of missionaries, I would ask them questions, but really they were leading questions because I already, you know, I was raised in it, you know, again, like I knew where they were going with it. But again, they're taught to be salesmen and they are very much trying to find, you know, what is your pain? What is your thing? So we can reach in and grab that. And the moment that you show yourself to be not really questioning, it's a goodbye. Thank you for your time and goodbye. So, and they're, you know, again, having friends that were missionaries, they're taught just like salesmen what the objections are going to be, how to respond to them, and, you know, stay really, really nice. And, you know what I mean? Like, again, they never got mad. Because I had a father-son team, and I talked about, you know, I would never abuse my kids in that way as to teach them the conclusion that there's an invisible sky ghost running everything. And I'm saying it to the dad and his son, which, I mean, obviously this is much later when I was more in a aggressive state with it. And even though I said that, I couldn't even tell if they understood what I just said because they were so incredibly pleasant.
It's just kind of like bounced off them.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, they just knew exactly what to say from it and said, you know, and got into the, well, you know, it's so nice to meet you and thank you for your time. And can we come talk to you again? And I was like, yeah, I'd prefer not. Okay, well, thank you for your time.
Or you could say, actually, I'd like to have your son show up if he'd like to come and talk about these things.
Yeah, I wish I had thought of that more then. I was still new to the way I was going to say it nowadays. But yeah, and even after I said those things, as they walked away, I went, I don't think they understood what I said. I think they're completely immune to anything outside of what their next sentence is going to be in leading you to what they believe.
Yeah.
It is what Ayn Rand called the anti-conceptual mentality that's encouraged by religion because, again, these terms are not defined objectively and logically. So it's kind of like your philosophical worldview is this amorphous flux with this authority figure looming in the background that's sort of inducing you to proselytize, to spread the word so that you don't have the fear and anxiety that's caused by doing things that are against the scripture or against the religious tenets and so forth, the preaching and all that.
Yeah.
It's really a mind bender.
Well, and it's much easier to do all that when you have the person from childhood, right? So it makes it so, I mean, here I am a 40-year-old man, and in the last few years, I've been learning logic for the first time in my life. Like, it was never taught.
Yes, we live in the age of pre-logic. That's just a simple way to look at it.
Yeah.
And it's hard. Logic is hard, even when I think I'm doing it.
When we've got a whole culture filled with illogic, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I'm trying to do it with people, and then they're so versed in being irrational or non-logical that it throws me up because I'm like, oh, wow, I guess you're right. Because I don't. What do I know? I'm barely learning. I'm like a child with logic because it's so completely not a part of what I was raised as. So, I mean, if that's all you're told from childhood, I mean, I can see why they probably have no idea what I said. I might as well have been speaking Chinese when I made the reference to child abuse and religion.
Mm-hmm.
They just heard nah, 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 and they're like, okay, next we're going to say goodbye. You know.
And, you know, you mentioned the term aggressive, that you were might have taken that stance, but I don't see that as aggression at all because, of course, literally it can't be. You were just speaking words, and that is non-coercive inherently.
For sure.
Unless you're threatening someone's life, which poses an imminent danger, but I would say you're being forthright and direct about it.
Yeah, well, and here, again, one of the Mormon cultural things I've noticed is that it's the intent that matters, not the actual action. And that's led me to all but one of my Mormon friends I haven't been able to hang out with because intent is what is the deal. So if they intended to meet you at 2 o'clock on Thursday to have a late lunch, then that's all that matters. If they didn't show up, it's still okay because they intended to. And it's the most odd thing. And when I left Salt Lake City, there's little things like that that are part of being nice. Like you're trying to be so nice that if somebody says, hey, do you want to do this? You just say yes.
Yeah.
And so that's why I was saying at the door by me, even completely without any sort of madness or anger or any of that in my voice, when I talked about, you know, religion and child abuse and tied them together, and I was completely just normal as if I'm talking right now, just like, oh my gosh, oh, let me tell you this thing. That is aggressive here in terms of just verbally aggressive. You know, obviously I wasn't threatening their lives, but compared to being so nice where you wave at everybody and just everything's so surface, saying anything below that surface is considered aggressive for sure.
It really is. You know, I was living down there a few months ago, too, and I think we had talks about this, that it felt like there's a matrix on top of a matrix there.
Oh, yeah.
Not only can you not notice, point out, and discuss the gun in the room in relation to statism, but this mythological belief system that is so woven into the fabric there is not to be discussed either.
Yeah.
Certainly not to be rejected as false.
For sure.
Although there's probably quite a few people in the area that do that. And of course, you know, there's those meetup groups. I think there's probably over 1,000 members in those various atheistic meetup groups there. And lots of stories told about how people suffered greatly, psychologically and even physically, being under that matrix or within that matrix.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even just that friend of mine that still is completely in that matrix and has to kind of keep his rationality hidden, or he feels he'll lose all of his friends, his family, his wife, everything.
Yeah, that must be really tough. And, you know, when you said that they perceive that as aggressive, when you say that, that you're not threatening their life, but perhaps from their point of view, it threatens their social life. It threatens their entire worldview based on how they're connected to other people. Like, they've kind of sold their logical, critical thinking faculty, you know, exchanged that for the social ties with others and the love and affection and all that attention and so forth. So as long as you don't try to get your need for logical clarity met, you're going to be okay. But not really okay, because you're circumventing your own mind's ability to see reality clearly. And that's, you know, you're paying the ultimate price there.
But look at what's at stake. I mean, on the surface, if you do, right, if you do acknowledge these things, look at what's at stake, because you're, you know, your entire life network. I mean, it's very clever. If this is by design, it's extraordinarily clever. Your entire network of everything you know is built around rejecting logic.
Yep.
Yes.
Because think about
it is by design, because they absolutely, they have church groups for every age group. They have it for singles. You can go to a singles church where everybody's singles. You know, if you want to go to the family church, then, you know, they literally design it so that at every age group and at every part of your life, you can be a part of that. And if you leave, believe me, I mean, as somebody who, you know, obviously doesn't go to church and doesn't particularly want to be around that at all, my dating is incredibly limited because of that. Because, you know, I mean, the absolute majority of people are Mormon here.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and the likelihood that somebody's going to date somebody that's even close to the camp of atheist is incredibly low.
Yeah. So any listeners in Salt Lake City of the female persuasion, take note.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's a crazy thing. Now, the only reason I'm in Salt Lake City is because my ex-wife and my kids are here and I want to be with them. But if that wasn't the case, I would be back in San Diego or wherever. But just so you don't go, why in the world are you still there? Then, you know, I've chosen.
Yeah. Do you think it's been really tough for your daughters to deal with this matrix?
Yeah.
Or do they kind of take it in sort of a, just as it comes, they kind of just express their views and move on, and kids are somewhat accepting of that?
They're still at the ages where I think that they're not really addressing that stuff. Like, they said that most of their friends are Mormon, but they're still mostly young kids that are just like, oh, let's go play on the swings.
Mm-hmm.
They're not like, oh, well, tell me why you believe in an invisible sky ghost. You know, so they're not quite to that yet. I imagine it'll be more apparent possibly in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Although I was able to get them both out of the indoctrination camps of public school, and they're both in, you know, private schools now that are completely different than that. So I'm hoping that that won't be the case at all, just because partially, you know, just of getting them out of the mainstream public school thing.
Yeah. Although a lot of the private schools there do have staff that are predominantly Mormon, right?
Yeah.
So it's like that issue, it's another hidden gun in the room that's not to be discussed a lot of the time, right? It's kind of passed off as just something we're not supposed to, it's, you know, politically incorrect to challenge this belief system in a sense. Like, can't we all get along? Can't we accept that this is just the predominant ideology here and this enriches people's lives? Like, all these people have had all these experiences about trying to get all their needs met through this religion, through this church, you know, because they, like you say, they market themselves as a place to get all your needs met.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sports, community things, family stuff, you know, on down the line.
Yeah, luckily this private school, I talked a lot about the whole religion thing, and none of them were Mormon, and they didn't say they were atheist, but they said, oh, no, we have no religious affiliation. We don't talk about anything to do with that. And I was happy because I also was looking at a Montessori school, and they had little sayings and stuff the kids would say before lunch, and it ended up being prayers, really.
Mm.
And I was like, that looks like a Mormon prayer. And she goes, oh, yes. Oh, good. You're Mormon. And I went, no, I was raised Mormon. And then she was like, oh, when I said no. And I'm like going, oh, great. So I'm going to pay all this extra money for my kids to come to your school to still have that underlying indoctrination of religion as well. It's like, no way.
Yeah, I've discussed on this religion series that people gravitate to religion not only because they were introduced to it as children, you know, whatever particular type of religion or denomination, they end up usually adopting what their parents introduced them to, but trying to get their need for meaning met, you know, and
yeah,
we live in a world in which is not really filled with logical clarity. So when we try to get our need for meaning met without any sort of logical clarity, it can distance us from what is really going on, you know? So we end up spending all of our time and our lives actually avoiding the very thing that we need to go to understand and make sense of this need for meaning and how we can get it met without sacrificing other needs for understanding and clarity and so forth.
This is the real crime, too, as far as I'm concerned, because like these systems like religion and school, where there's just this constant assault on curiosity, where the basic setup is, listen, everything is known, so sit down and we'll tell you about it. And how that leads to, in adults, this intellectual apathy about the unknown. So much imagination and thought is wasted on just trying to perpetuate that belief system. You know, it reminds me of, this is a loose tie here, but the book, Wes, that we talked about before, The Power of Your Subconscious Mind, where it explains what people call prayer as possibly, you know, sending information from one part of the brain to another. And
rather than across the cosmos, right?
Exactly. So when people want those easy answers, because they do have that need for meaning, and they've been trained to, you know, not be independently curious and not to be intellectually adventurous. We see this subversion of intellectual and creative potential that could be used to gain a deepening understanding of the workings of our own minds. Like, that's all being sacrificed by the church and by the schools, which is very similar. It's like the church of the state. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's the real crime in all of this for me.
And when you realize that your life is going to end and essentially your mind, consciousness, spirit, whatever you want to call it, is going to be completely obliterated, that really makes this insight really sobering, doesn't it? Because at the end of your days, if you've been sort of immersed in this way of sleepwalking through your existence, through all these mystical beliefs or status beliefs or what have you that don't enable you to actually look at things clearly, you're going to feel probably a lot of regret if you look at things clearly later on in life.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, like, have I wasted my life spending all this time thinking about, reading about things that actually don't pertain to living the good life, living in a way that is most life enriching?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I was going to say, as well as what Brett was saying, my oldest daughter just turned 15, and she actually heard me, I believe, talking to you, Wes, about how I was doing everything I could to help let my girls escape from public school. And and really the only thing in the way was my ex-wife. She didn't understand unschooling and a lot of the other things that I was really interested in. But she heard me actually saying, I want to, you know, go get them like POWs out of this before their curiosity is completely destroyed.
Yeah.
Okay, so she had heard me say something like that. I didn't know she heard me say it, but recently we had been talking about some business stuff because I teach internet business and I do it. And, you know, I've been letting my kids come to me when they're curious about it. And I was talking to my oldest daughter, her name's McKenna, and we were talking about things she's interested in because she wanted to start a business. And so one of the processes we do is we try and talk about things that they're already interested in, like hobbies or even stuff they would like to learn about and be an expert at. And she goes, I think you're right. I think they destroyed my curiosity because I'm not really curious about anything. And she's like, help, how do I do that? And I'm like, oh my gosh, at 15, she's already realizing.
The system has worked on her, essentially, yeah.
Yeah, she's like, how do you develop curiosity? And I'm like, oh man, like there's a whole book right there. How do you get curiosity back when it's been ripped from you?
Yeah.
And that brings up the issue of deschooling, right? Going through this period of time where you're decompressing from all of these extrinsic motivators that have stripped away your intrinsic motivation and your own sense of identity of what you want to do and sense of purpose and so forth. And last time I called into Brett's radio show, which is, I think, every Thursday night, right, Brett?
Yep.
Yep.
10 p.m. Eastern.
10 p.m. Eastern time, yeah. So make sure to tune into that to listen to School Sucks Project Radio or School Sucks...
We call it School Sucks Radio because I think that's a little bit clearer what it is, and you can watch our video feed at schoolsucksproject.com/live.
Gotcha. Yeah, but I mentioned the Teenage Liberation Handbook by Grace Llewellyn, and that might be a book she can read to kind of get a whole bunch of ideas about what this process is about and how to regain her sense of purpose and curiosity.
Yeah, you mentioned that before. I actually bought it and gave it to her, and she's been having an incredible amount of trouble, she says, getting through it.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah, just keeping her interest.
So that kind of gets back to the curiosity thing too, right?
Yeah, because, well, and this was one of the tough things. I had both of, I have two daughters, and I had both of them listen to you guys talk about logic. And, you know, I would stop it here and there and go, oh, do you understand what this means? And they were like, no, I don't know what, yeah. I don't even know what objective reality means, even though I've talked.
It's pretty high-level stuff, what we were talking about, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I
but
was
I
like,
played some of our stuff for adults. I mean, it depends on your willingness to want to hear it, because, sure. Like, I've played – I tried to when I started doing Complete Liberty, like, over 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was real excited about it, and I would make CDs and try to hand them out to people. And, you know, someone said, you know, you're talking when people already have decided what, and this is not applicable, I think, to your kids in this situation, Jeremy, but I think when people have already decided what they want to feel, anything that's intellectually challenging, they can dismiss as, you know, you're talking over people's heads.
Sure.
But yeah, I will agree with Wes that that was a relatively advanced comment. How old are the girls?
12 and 15.
Hmm. Yeah.
Now, we talk about that stuff, but it's an interesting thing to watch them go, you know, here they are, even at 12 and 15, and they haven't heard a lot of those words.
No.
And why would they? You know, I mean, obviously, that's part of stripping away understanding that there's an objective reality. Well, they've never even heard of that. So I'm like trying to explain every word going, okay, well, here's the difference between this and this. And I'm still relatively new, honestly. I mean, even though it's been a few years, I was most certainly had all that ripped out of me. So anyway, yeah, it was just interesting, that whole idea of the curiosity being sucked away, because even my 15-year-old, now my 12-year-old, she's still very, very curious, but I can see points where she'll just turn it off and would rather go watch TV, because she's been taught to, you know, you're not supposed to question too much. And really, you're not supposed to question. I mean, she got in trouble, actually, for questioning in public school, where I even had to argue with a teacher about that. And, you know, and that was the point. And again, it was actually, it's so funny because it's you and Brett that I'm talking to about this thing, because I believe it was actually you and Brett somehow along the way that taught me about unschooling and thinking different about that, that mean even made me go, I've got to get my girls out of here. This is a prison camp. What?
Yeah.
You know, so
it's destroying their intrinsic motivation.
Yeah. Well, and then to talk to them and see it being snuffed out, or mostly has been snuffed out, and going, oh my gosh, how do I bring that back? Like, now this is a whole new, it's almost like another industry. How do we bring back our curiosity? I'm not sure how it happened for me years ago, because I'm unbelievably curious to certain degrees, of course, but you know, bringing it back in people that don't already have it, maybe that's even part of, you know, what's behind this whole religion thing. How can we turn curiosity back on?
Yeah, because it's not that it's just been stifled and suppressed and sometimes removed, the intrinsic motivation. It's that also it's been replaced or capped off with the popular culture sense of enjoying things, you know, all the different things that people, especially teenagers, immerse themselves in to enjoy stuff within the popular culture that is somewhat antithetical to thinking about these deeper issues.
And I think it's a lifelong process, too. I think there's two aspects of it. Like, de-schooling, different from unschooling, removing the messages of school is a lifelong process, especially that requires constant maintenance, because we live in a schooled world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other aspect of that as well is that most of the damage was done at an incredibly formative time. in all of our lives, where it was significantly impactful than having that experience would have been later on in life.
Yeah, just look at the kids on South Park.
Sure, yeah. And I catch myself falling into old habits and bad habits all the time, and you know, having to stop and question, like, why am I doing this? Why am I thinking this? I think that it's continuous maintenance. But one thing about unschooling, which, again, there is a distinction there, but one of the quotes that I like about unschooling is, it's just how adults learn, but for kids.
Yep.
You know, it's like self-directed.
Yeah.
Like, most of the things that I know that are valuable are things that I taught myself because I wanted to learn them. So I think that the more freedom that we have when we get out of the public school, when we get out of higher education, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
And we have that freedom again, and there is no quote unquote intellectual authority, that will start to come back because our learning process becomes more self-directed again, just because those other factors don't exist anymore. But that doesn't mean that it isn't something that people still need to be very cognizant of and continue to work on because of what happened when we were so young.
Yeah, and there are all the innumerable distractions in our culture that kind of draw us away from really authentically getting in touch with what we want and how we want to learn things.
Mm.
Yeah, it actually reminds me of the Sudbury school that's here that I was trying to get my daughters to be able to go to. Mm-hmm. And their mother was like, well, what's to say they're not going to just play video games all day if that's what, you know, is open. Now, she was talking to one of the facilitators at the school, and they talked about, oh, well, there is a decompression time, or a what did you call it?
Deschooling.
Deschooling, where they want to see if this is real. Are you really going to let me be in charge of my schooling? And they will test in all sorts of ways. And they were saying it could take months per year they've been traditionally schooled for them to release that and start really enjoying and getting back to that intrinsic motivation. And if, you know, my ex-wife was like, oh, no way. But I was going, well, I mean, I don't know how many years it took me to finally get to the point where I got back to that high level of curiosity, but it was a long time. You know, so even at their age, there's all this stuff to get rid of just to be able to be curious again.
No, I mean, once a week, guys, I'm probably, you know, I look at a task and I say, oh, it's going to be hard. Yeah. I don't want to do that.
Where's that video game?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Or some kind of procrastination, or like, oh, it's going to be so much work. And just these associations, like all the work that I do. Even like the scope of any project is going to involve tasks that are fun and exciting and inspiring, and tasks that are kind of repetitious and mundane. And still, when those things that need to be done but aren't fun but are part of the big picture of something that is entirely the product of my goals, you know, my intrinsic motivation, even when it goes to those little things that are just part of it that there's no escaping from, I say, you know, I feel like I'm jumping back to those old habits. So that way of thinking, I think, is still present. And it does. I mean, it's like I said, it's lifelong.
Yeah. And of course, it reminded me of that quote, I think it was by Alfie Cohn, about the modern educational system, traditional education, that has a teacher sage on the stage that imposes assignments and grades and all that stuff, that they actually threaten you with giving you more learning, i.e. extra assignments, if you don't do as you're told.
Yeah.
Right. So what does that do for intrinsic motivation about learning?
This is one of the biggest wake-up calls of my career, too, with something called No Child Left Behind tutoring years ago. This was something that I was involved with, where if kids showed that they had deficits compared to the average in areas of math and reading and writing, and these were first grade, second grade, third grade kids, they would stay after school to spend time with a tutor that had been imposed on them to practice. I mean, can you think of a way to get somebody less excited? You know, a young person, 6, 7, 8 years old. I mean, I did this kind of tutoring, and it lasted a couple months, and then I said, I can't, this is horrible, this is the worst thing I've ever done, and I stopped doing it, because I just saw, I mean, you can feel a person's ambition and curiosity just being crushed, yeah. You know,
And then when we see the final product, right, after the Comprachicos have molded this person into something, some horrific shape, that is considered the new normal, right?
Yeah.
That's just taken as the normal. And the people that we see that have been through that process are normal.
Yep.
The pathology of normalcy, in a sense.
Yeah.
Well, and that was the thing that my ex-wife said when I was talking about unschooling and trying to teach her about this. She's like, I just want them to be normal. Like, they're going to be so weird.
Yes, like all the other kids. Misshapen and not having intrinsic motivation and all those things. And, of course, inherent in her perspective is this anxiety, perhaps, maybe fear and distrust of being able to be your own self-starter, you know, to be able to find the things that are going to nourish you and enrich your life. So it's better to, you know, if people are going to be coerced and put into a school, it's best that they be told subjects that I presume are going to be helpful for them in the long run, right?
Mm.
So there's this inherent mistrust of kids to do things that are beneficial for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's very tragic. Here's the Cone quote in context in my section on education, the psychology of liberty. The present educational system confesses its ineffectiveness by upholding the belief that tests and grades are necessary to keep students studying and mastering the material. Quote, what is even more appalling, Elfie Cohn stated, many teachers hold out the possibility of more academic work as a punishment or the possibility of less work as a reward, which drives home the lesson that learning is something a student should want to avoid, end quote.
Wow. Well, I can tell you that my teaching, what I do for a living, teaching people about business, I think one of the major, major mindset problems that they have for being able to become successful at doing their business is the same idea that without somebody just telling them exactly what to do and how to do it and when to do it, that they're just not worthy of doing that. Because
mm-hmm.
we found that the people in our coaching are far more likely, like if they do direct coaching with us, they're far more likely to keep going.
Yeah.
But we have to really, really like give them exactly step by step and give them permission to do it.
Be the guides on the side, in a sense, encouraging them.
Yeah, and almost like for them to actually do it, there's this weird level of permission. We've even been trying to decide maybe if we give them graduation certificates because people want to like be able to go, okay, I am now eligible to do this thing. Somebody has told me it's okay that I go start a site about Spanish, learning Spanish. And it's so weird because, you know, again, my business partner and I definitely agree with things like you guys about government and religion and stuff, but it's weird to see it in play in full-grown adults going, please tell me what to do.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do this on my own. You've got to constantly tell me if this is okay, what I'm doing.
Mm.
Yeah, I like that you did a show talking about nonviolent communication and needs and so forth. I think Jason, your partner on the show, by the way, it's Internet Business Mastery Podcast. I encourage everyone to check that out because you guys do focus a lot on motivation and just your mindset about being able to achieve things on your own as an entrepreneur and start an online business and do it. But, you know, that's where the nonviolent communication perhaps comes in to address the fears and anxieties within that person to, you know, get their need for independence and choice and just the ability to do things in an efficacious way. You know, we have a need for effectiveness, a need for self-esteem. And that's probably the big one that needs to be sort of nurtured in that process, I think.
Yeah, we talk about the six pillars of self-esteem as one of our biggest books as well. So, I mean, those were, and when we do coaching classes, we give those books away. That's what we give as gifts. The nonviolent communication and six pillars, because really that's one of the biggest things in the way of that kind of success. I mean, really probably any success, but in terms of, you know, my business success is completely hindered by that, you know, self-esteem that's been destroyed over the years through the system we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, speaking of that, to get back kind of on the religion topic, there was an article on CatoAtLiberty.org. And it was written by Neil McCluskey, titled, Want a Disproven Belief? Government Schools Teach Good Science. Much is being made by school choice opponents of a report that a Christian school in Louisiana, eligible to receive students in the state's new voucher program, uses a textbook that asserts the Loch Ness Monster is real and a dinosaur, writes Washington Post education columnist Valerie Strauss. quote, "This is where support of vouchers is leading us, to the public paying for a child to learn that the Loch Ness Monster was a dinosaur and coexisted with humans. This is important to young Earth creationists, who believe that Earth was created no longer than 10,000 years ago, not the 4.5 billion years estimated by science. They also believe that dinosaurs were on Noah's Ark." If people want to believe this and they want their children to learn it in school, that's fine. The public shouldn't have to pay for it. Unquote. I can certainly see why paying for this sort of thing would disturb a lot of people. It's a major reason tax credit programs, which let individuals and corporations choose to whom they will donate, are preferable to vouchers. Let's, however, use this to confront another extremely dubious belief that many would never challenge. Government schooling leads to good science instruction. First, no matter how loudly government failure deniers might protest, the government is omnipotent, damn it. Government schooling does not overcome religious belief. The latest Gallup poll assessing views on human origins came out a few weeks ago and found, as it has since 1982, the vast majority of Americans believe that God created human beings, and a plurality believes that God created us in our, quote, present form. Only 15% hold that human beings evolved without any divine involvement. And this is with roughly 85% of students attending public schools. Next, let's take a look at overall science achievement. According to the latest National Assessment of Educational Progress results, only 32% of U.S. 8th graders are proficient in science, quote, proficient, and 43% of private school students are proficient versus 31% for public schools. I'm not sure what their classification for proficient is here, but a significant part of the difference is likely that private schools tend to serve better prepared kids. But the data certainly doesn't suggest that public schooling beats private when it comes to science instruction. Finally, there's the reason government schools are so inept at teaching science. All people, no matter what their beliefs, are forced to support public schools, a perfect recipe for wrenching conflict. To avoid war without end, some 60% of high school biology teachers gloss over the mega flashpoint that is evolution. That's amazing. 60% of high school biology teachers gloss over the mega flashpoint that is evolution?
I don't believe I was taught it at all, by the way.
That's amazing. The result is that no one, no matter what their beliefs, gets coherent biology instruction. The solution to this is obvious. Let the people go. Let them freely choose what their children will learn, eliminating the need to fight. No longer force them to pay for, quote, free government schools, then pay again for education they like, which is what you're doing, Jeremy. You're paying double, right? The property taxes in addition to the private fees.
Oh, yeah.
Unfortunately, all too often, the self-proclaimed logic-driven defenders of science reject this argument. In part, this is because of their heartfelt conviction that all children must learn proper science. That, however, has shackled them to the utterly illogical belief that some way, somehow, human and government reality will be magically overcome. That's more than just a little ironic. Interesting.
Wow. Yeah, it's pretty painful, the double pain thing, because the property taxes here are crazy. And then to pay for school on top of that, you know, my bill for my two girls to go to this private school is more than my mortgage by quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, that's everything. That's the extra, you know, I mean, like, I don't know how. I mean, I just happen to have a business that does well enough that I can do that, but I can't imagine most people would even have that opportunity to get kids out of that.
Yeah.
You know, because there aren't – the only other option here was a charter school, which I didn't really realize what that was. And last year, they went to this charter school, and what they claim on their site when they're walking you around the school is completely different than what it really is. It's really just public school, really.
Mm-hmm.
And they just don't call it a principal. They call it something else. Oh, we have no principal, and we have no this. Yeah, they do.
We have the director.
Yeah, and it is a principal, and he does exactly the same exact things. But and that's the only other option if you don't have the money to do it the other way.
Uh-huh. And Brett, isn't this symbolic of the old refrain that people use that advocate government projects, that even though all the evidence shows that they fail miserably, we need to keep funding them, keep trying different ways to achieve the results we want?
Yeah, I was looking at a criticism recently of this documentary that came out, I think within the last couple of years, called Waiting for Superman.
Uh-huh.
And it said that the documentary was inaccurate because it glossed over the real problems of the school system, number one being that it was, quote, criminally underfunded, unquote.
Yes, criminally. Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's a crime not to pay your taxes, by the way.
Well, I mean, you would think that certainly there's plenty of money being shoveled into that system. So,
yeah, never enough.
It's interesting, right? Because you can't say that anywhere else except for government.
Mm, true. What business is going to run their operations that way, right?
Yeah.
Well, if you had somebody come to do a service, which, you know, the government school system masquerades as a service, and they did a poor job, I mean, just imagine like a home maintenance service or something like that, a repair. And
they put out a press release that say they're criminally underfunded.
You say to the service provider, this is terrible. This is like real hack work. And their response was not sorry or what needs to be fixed, but was crap. I must not have charged you enough.
Exactly.
Yeah, if you pay triple, I might do better.
Might, by the way.
We'll see. Yep. We'll see.
Who Even knows? Though I already said it was going to be this, you didn't get that. But still, if I charge you triple, maybe I'll give you what I already said I would give you. It's crazy.
Yeah, so isn't this interesting in light of how the progressives or liberals look at public school, you know? They see it as this way to stave off the Christian hordes from taking over the country because we're teaching kids science in public school, right?
I think that conservatives have expressed what I believe to be some valid interests about some of the things that are being taught in the government school. I mean, it's interesting. This is what we talked about on my show last week. It's progressives are convinced that schools are controlled by conservative interests. The whole charter school movement is adding fuel to that fire because they say this is the corporate takeover and privatization of education.
Mm-hmm.
Conservatives believe that schools are controlled by progressive interests, and people who can see beyond or see from above all of that quasi-debate, it's not even a real debate, know that the school is controlled by state and status quo interests, and it has been for over a century. And I think that both of the things that we've discussed, both of these things that are imposed and inflicted on young people, well, they represent in their purest form, you know, two of mankind's highest aspirations. The school, public school, for some reason translates into education, and that translates into enlightenment. That's one. And the church or religion translates into spiritual fitness and salvation.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, some extremely philosophically corrupt and predatory people are going to gravitate towards those institutions and try to control them and use them for their own benefit. I think I always have, always will, because they masquerade as these great things, which neither of them are.
Coercive power corrupts, absolutely, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
When you're trying to get your needs met at the expense of others, you know, that's the whole thing with, you know, the liberals talk about wanting to have universal health care. At whose expense? You know, the context is dropped there.
Yeah.
Someone pays for certain services. Now, it's either individuals of their own free will, which is honorable and respectful in how a free marketplace operates, or it's using coercion to do so, telling people, demanding that they do it or else they get punished, they get fined, they get jailed. I mean, how atavistic of a mindset is that? And again, it's indicative, it's reflective of this domination culture we live in that has a lot of fear about independence and your own personal choice and autonomy, and a lot of anxiety about being able to get your needs met without using coercion, you know?
Mm.
That yeah. That actually reminds me of, I just listened to Penn's Sunday School from Penn and Teller. And he said that people say, oh, well, you know, if we don't have religion, people just run around raping people. And he says, I've raped and killed exactly the amount of people that I wanted to,
mm-hmm.
even with all the laws, which is none. You know, he's like, just the fact that they're quote unquote spiritual moral laws or, you know, actual laws in terms of status saying that this is how you have to act doesn't stop people from doing that if they're going to. And it also isn't the thing that's stopping him anyway.
Yes.
Right. And it just reminded me of that when you were, you know, just saying that made that come to my mind that, you know, I choose things in my life regardless of what that law is, whether it's spiritual or otherwise. I try to be a good person because of what comes to me and because I enjoy doing that and not because some law said I shouldn't do this or that. Whether it's spiritual or otherwise, right? A commandment?
Yeah, so it gets back to intrinsic motivation and being able to trust your own judgment and value judgments. You know, most people don't want to hurt other people.
Yeah.
But there's this sort of subconscious process going on underneath that that government exploits, you know, and takes advantage of. And people end up just slipping into this mindset of, yeah, do it or else.
Yeah.
Now, there were a couple of video clips I wanted to play so we could chew on a little bit, get you guys' perspective on this. One of them is titled The Hopelessness of Atheism, posted by this outspoken atheist on YouTube named Thunderfoot. And the other one that he did, we can wrap up the show with, called The Internet, Where Religions Come to Die.
Nice.
I think it's pretty fitting for that. But this one is, I think, a couple Christians that did a video that he put on his show talking about how atheism or atheists are essentially depressed and hopeless.
I know for a fact you, Thunderfoot, and other atheists suffer from depression. It's evident in your voice and the way you talk and your worldview.
But I have looked into the core of this reactor and seen beauty. Now I know what many of you will say. It's just a bunch of metal cans and radioactive pipes with a kind of pretty glowing swimming pool. Where is the beauty? The beauty does not come from what it looks like, but from what it represents. When I look at this reactor, what I see is almost an irrelevance. In my mind's eye, I perceive the symphony of mathematics, materials, nuclear physics, thermodynamics, and engineering, spawned from the pooled knowledge of mankind, by a communal action of a civilization and given form with the single intention of further expanding horizons. And it inspires me with hope for what such a civilization may yet achieve.
Is simply a fact of atheism, that it leaves you without hope and it cripples your ability to live a hopeful, joyful life.
We see further than the mighty thinkers of old, not because we are greater, but because of the inheritance of insight that they bequeathed to us. The knowledge and appreciation we have for the universe is a gift from those who dedicated their lives to understanding. The problem defines itself. We stand on the shoulders of giants, and thereby we see further than they. But in the very act of climbing on their shoulders, we forge anew. We serve the purpose of laying the foundations for those who are to come after us. For those who have seen the flame of knowledge penetrate the murk of the unknown, and the wonders that it has revealed, who would not desire to pass on a brighter flame, such that those who come to wield this light can greatly supersede our insight, just as our vision penetrates further than those of old? There can be few acts more noble than being part of a society that values, preserves, and increases the knowledge for the minds yet to come.
It is the very purpose of our existence. Without God, life is meaningless, and dark and death is going to absolutely obliterate us, and there is no hope for the future. That is simply a fact of atheism, that it leaves you without hope, and it cripples your ability to live a hopeful, joyful life.
Ah, the snake oil merchant, peddling the promise of eternal life to the short-sighted, neurotic mortals who can be seduced by the vacuous promise of eternal life. Eternal life would be no gift, but arguably one of the most horrific tortures that could be laid on a sentient being. I mean, sure, the first million years might be fun, but what about the next million, and the billion after that, and the trillion after that, and you still have eternity left? This will never end. There will never be an end in sight. Eternal life is merely the poorly thought-out fiction of mortals who have gotten greedy. Eternal life would be a curse. Without death, there is no reason to do things. And this is how things would remain for eternity. And eternity after that. And eternity after that. I strongly urge you to accept your mortality. Do not let your fear of your inevitable death make you waste your only mortal life pursuing phantasms and delusions. Look at yourself in the mirror. For billions of years, those particles which are currently looking back at you have circulated in the universe. But for a brief instance, they have coalesced in you. Rejoice in the impressive instance, till they dissipate whence they came. Delight that you are a spark of light in the universe. Life is so much more vibrant and vivid without Bronze Age paranoid superstitions that cloud and contract the mind with some empty and undesirable promise that sparks can burn forever. For the radiance of the spark that burns boldly and brightly echoes through the halls of eternity, while the spark that neurotically fritters away its fuel might as well have never been. Our time is finite. This gives our lives meaning. It gives our lives purpose. It gives our lives urgency. Live life today. Savor it.
So the rational guy sounded depressed and sad.
He sure did, didn't he?
He's like incredibly passionate and, you know, excited. It's just so funny how people want to put that on somebody else, the despair and stuff that they might be feeling, and they just want to project that onto others.
Yeah.
I would say, too, and obviously I can only speak from my own experience, but relating to what Jeremy said, some of the most miserable people that I've ever come across in my entire life were the ones who would also say things like, God has a plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everything happens for a reason.
I don't need to take control. I don't need to take action. You know, I don't need to exercise my own volition. God has some kind of plan, so...
Just take the hands off the wheel, right?
Things have been crappy lately, but this is going somewhere, so... Yeah.
Yeah, and it's really ironic that they strive for happiness in another life, in another reality, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that is really a confession that... This life isn't to be savored in all its wonder in so many ways. I mean, in many ways, we haven't even hardly begun to see how wonderful and amazing life is, because as a culture, as a species, we're still immersed in these mythologies and so forth that are blinding us to the nature of reality and nature of our own beings, our own lives within it.
Yeah, I'll tell you, anytime I feel any sort of down feelings, it comes from, you know, the realization of my slavery to these things.
Yeah.
And not the reality of how awesome life is in general.
Mm-hmm.
Or that, you know, it's going to end one day for me. You know, it's more like, wow, you know, I just paid half of my productive wage, what I've made, to people I don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
With, you know, the point of a gun.
And who knows what they're going to use it for.
Yeah, and they very well may use it against me directly. Like, this is insanity.
Yeah, they've squandered $2 billion taxpayer dollars on essentially a spy facility right next to Salt Lake City there.
Yeah, that's awesome.
To filter all the information from people's emails and cell phone calls and everything goes into this thing. $2 billion they spent on this thing. Just to spy on the American people, to protect them, of course, from terrorists.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely a cause to go, okay, I've got to get through the kind of extreme sadness that comes from that.
Mm-hmm.
Or also just the idea that, you know, supposedly rational, happy people around me actually think they're going to go to heaven for eternity. Like,
yeah.
What? It's so hard to all the different needs that I have for relating with people and community and this kind of thing just get completely destroyed by these mythologies that we, you know, have to live through, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but what an awesome historical behavior management tool it has been.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know the answer. And I would be interested which, as far as concepts were concerned, which one came first, heaven or hell? Because I think that, what's that Rand quote, faith and force are corollaries?
Yes.
Well, you know, I mean, I think you can say, do what I say or bad things will happen to you. But you can't always deliver on that promise. And maybe eventually it got to a point where it was, well, the punishment is, it's not what I'm going to do. You know, it's eternal.
Mm-hmm. It's what he's going to do. Capital H.
Yeah, I can't give you any evidence of it now, but it's going to last forever and it's going to be bad or good, you know, if you you do all the right things.
Supernatural justice.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do see a lot of that in Hollywood films too, you know. That's a common theme.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I hadn't heard somebody take heaven and eternity so far. I've had entire joke sessions trying to explain or help people see through heaven. Like, I know my grandma, you know, very big on talking about heaven, and then I asked her to explain it. And anytime I want any sort of details passed, oh, it's going to be just wonderful forever. I'm like, okay, well, you know, what are you going to do? What's the first 100 years look like? And she's like, oh, I've always wanted to paint and da da da. And I was like, okay, now we're at 1,000 years. You've painted everything. Like, what? You know, you are the master of the you know, like you've done that to the absolute end point. You know, now do you sculpt? I don't know. She's like, then I'll travel. Because, you know, the whole thing with the there was something that with the Mormon thing is at some point it's going to be here.
And they get to take their bodies with them in a sense, yeah. Right? To have be on a planet somewhere.
So she's like, oh, I would love to travel through these areas that I didn't travel through. I said, okay, so 50 years later, you've seen everything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what are you going to do? You know, and she's like, oh, you just don't understand. And I'm like, okay, so explain it. You know, like, explain what I don't understand. Because if you think of trillions of years and then you still have eternity, you know, my mind just like the gears in my mind were like scratching against it. You know, like you've lived a trillion years and now there's still eternity. That's a great saying.
Yes. And of course, suicide isn't an option, is it, in that realm?
No.
Now, wait a minute. Does it happen outside of like reality? Like this is in some completely other realm where you couldn't be saved by like an asteroid like 15 trillion years into this thing?
Yeah, there's nothing like that. And you can just teleport.
No, it's basically a padded room, a padded universe.
Yeah. Well, and you can teleport. I was like, so, you know, how much time does it take to travel? Instant. I'm like, oh, well, then let's cut that 50 years down to like 3 weeks. You could just see everything all, you know, like it's just.
Let's get our need for efficiency met here.
Yeah. And that's if you didn't get to become a god,
mm-hmm.
Right? Because in the Mormon religion, there is that possibility. And one of the things that I had a discussion with my business partner back when we first started together, when he still was Mormon, was we were talking about him and his wife. And of course, they're in the Mormon church. When you die, if you've been married in the temple, you're sealed for eternity. So you're going to be together for eternity. And I was like going, okay, so what if you both become gods? How does that work? Do you like meet after work? Hey, yeah, I started this whole new continent today. It's pretty awesome. You know, it's coming along well. And and then the wife's like, oh, yeah, my people, I had to flood them. Yeah, you know, I had to go through that problem again.
Those sinners.
Yeah. Do you talk together? And I said, and what if, let's say your wife becomes a god and you don't? Do you just hang around? Like, do you get to just watch what she does with her whole entire universe? Like, any sort of thought behind this whole thing just unravels it. I mean, like, I did it in a joking way with them, so mostly they laughed, but they were like, well, actually, the Book of Mormon doesn't exactly explain what happens, you know, once you become a god. And I was like, well, what if once you become a god, you decide to make the opposite commandments of what it was that you had to fulfill to become a god?
Mm-hmm.
So all your people have whole new commandments, you know, and maybe she decides there are no commandments. Can you do that? Like, is that okay?
I guess anything goes up there, right?
Yeah. And you know, they were kind of going, oh, well, you know, no book says exactly what that happens. But it's a weird thing. It reminds me of that whole idea of living a trillion years and then you've got eternity is, you know, what really happens there? And like you said, you can't die. Like a trillion years is like, I'm just done. And they're like, sorry.
Been there, done that. Sorry.
you'll think different in the next trillion years. You'll be fine.
Now, do you have the whole universe to explore?
probably it might even be multiverses, because each person gets their sort of fantasies.
Yeah.
Because this is just unbridled imagination packed full of contradictions. So whatever floats your boat, I guess.
Sure, because...
Jeez, you know, even with the whole universe, even with the whole universe, I can't imagine needing more than like 400 quadrillion years.
Yeah.
Like even with the whole universe.
Yeah, I mean, I've been telling people just 1,000 years for starters in relation to the anti-aging zone and all that, and being able to reverse the aging process in humans, which all takes place in reality. You know, I'm a bit distressed when I hear him talk about humans being greedy for wanting more life.
Yeah.
Wanting an afterlife, in a sense. I mean, the real issue is they're imagining things in a world that's not reality.
Yeah.
So it's just, again, an unbridled imagination with lots of contradictions. But if you just stay in this reality and you say, I'm enjoying my life, life is wonderful, how do we go about extending that process? We can shoot for quality, but also quantity. And I don't think there's any disparaging aspects of greed in that.
No, I want to live as long as I can. As long as, again, it's that quality aspect, you know, if the slavery deepens.
Yes. Yeah. The question is your life wonderful? Are you happy? And how to go about achieving happiness in this unfree world that we live in? And so therefore it begs the question, how do we get to a freer world?
Yeah.
Disseminating these ideas that are true and bringing the conversation to people and discussing things in a way that tries to connect with what's alive in that person, what fears and anxieties and insecurities and, you know, prior indoctrination are motivating the generation and the promotion of these false beliefs.
Yeah, that makes sense. I know that, you know, as far as the religion and the imagination thing, once I asked my grandma that, I'd started asking all of my family what heaven looked like, and almost nobody had any sort of direct answer, which was quite interesting when we talk back about curiosity and maybe even imagination as part of curiosity, because somewhere along the line, the curiosity was ripped out of them, but they were told that there's this heaven where everything's just awesome. Mm-hmm. And they just went, oh, okay.
God can make it better.
Yeah, because my grandma at one point went, oh, I've never thought of this. I guess then I would do this. And I'm like going, if you're basing everything on this one target and you haven't thought through that target, like there's just some weird thing in my mind going, wow, that's the marriage of the whole state and religion thing.
Mm-hmm.
Take out your curiosity so we can just say a one word. Oh, it's going to be awesome. And you're like, yes.
And never actually define the word coherently.
Yep. Yeah, because when, you know, I was asking Jason, you know, well, what does heaven look like? There wasn't a defined, oh, in the Doctrine and Covenants, I can't remember how to say it, the third book after the main Mormon book, it goes into 3 solid chapters on exactly what heaven looks like. Well, of course, there's not that at all. It's, and I mean, rightly so, from creating it to just let you have your own imagination. It's whatever you think.
And of course, sadly, that kind of conversation could just as easily take place in a lunatic asylum.
100%. Yeah.
You know, or under the bridge somewhere with some homeless people. I mean, really, it's that disconnected. It's that dissociated from reality.
Absolutely. Unless you're making a film.
Yeah. So, Brett, what do you think about the transhumanism thing about being able to maximize your lifespan and shoot for indefinite lifespans? Because there is a sort of a contradiction that he's postulating here if you say that you can live for eternity, but that's physically impossible given the nature of the universe. Now, I know there's lots of transhumanist discussions about replicating yourself, creating backups of yourself through different parts of the cosmos.
Yeah.
But then again, you get in the issue of transmitting information, so you can't update your copies instantaneously. Right. So there's all kinds of discussions for years on the internet about all this stuff. But the bottom line is, at best, what we can have is indefinite lifespans where we will die from an accident or some debilitation at some point. But we can actually cease the aging process and reverse it, perhaps rehabilitate ourselves, you know, the tissues that have been damaged over the years. And that's what Aubrey de Grey's been spearheading, this notion of strategies for an engineering negligible senescence. So
sure, and I'm definitely all in favor of that, and I'd certainly like to live a quality life as long as possible. I mean, as you extend life longer and longer, statistically speaking, eventually you're going to get struck by lightning or eaten by a shark.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the longer you live. Now, I approach this topic cautiously because One of the criticisms, I think the very valid criticisms about trying to understand God as far as religious people are concerned, is that they're trying to superimpose these human concepts onto this being, mm-hmm. onto the universe. Like, how did the universe begin? Well, beginning, that's just, there might be, something there that we are yet to understand, but people take these concepts understood by human beings and they try to apply them to these mythical ideas.
Anthropomorphism.
Sure. So it is possible that from what I know, from where I am, there are certainly some things about eternal life that might be unfathomable to me at this point. You know?
Eternal life in terms of, you mean indefinite lifespans, or do you actually mean...
Indefinite lifespans.
Okay.
No death from natural causes.
Yeah. Internal causes through aging, yeah.
Sure. From where I stand today, that would seem, just as the man in the video is describing, like torturous, eventually.
And that goes to the idea that you can choose how long you want to live, right?
Yeah.
But life is really a succession of moment, present moment experiences. So where you are with yourself in reality in the present moment kind of determines your mood about those successions of moments going on in the future in perpetuity, perhaps.
Mm. But there might be some benefit to that that right now is beyond my comprehension.
Mm. Yeah. So that reminds me when he says, and I've heard this before, and I actually used to sort of contend this, that if it weren't for death, then we wouldn't, you know, be impelled to achieve all these things and do all these, you know, have all these experiences. Because our lives are finite and we look at our lifespans with a conceptual faculty, we say, oh shit, I better get my act together. I better, you know, achieve all these things. I got to create this bucket list, right?
Yeah.
And if we had an indefinite lifespan, would people be as encouraged to do those sorts of things? I think that speaks to the nature of creative thinking and imagination and the ability to drive yourself. Because, all you have is a present moment, and you could die through an asteroid impact. We could die right now if an asteroid hit the Earth. I mean, it's a veritable shooting gallery up there, and they've only identified a few of them. So it's like, what does all that mean in the grand scheme of things? I think it's about prioritizing what you value, right?
It's an interesting thought experiment as well. Like, what would be the chemical or biological impact? Like for example, on the human sex drive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if part of sex drive is chemical, the removal of the possibility, at least in the short term or in the near term, of death, would that diminish maybe the male sex drive, maybe more than the female sex drive, almost down to nothing? If part of the chemical aspect of the male sex drive is to spread a seed. Now, obviously, today, and you know, for the last few 100,000 years, there's much more that's factored into the decision, or I wouldn't have even called it a decision before that. But there is still a chemical aspect to sex drive. So I wonder, I don't know, again, this is just speculation, but I wonder if that would be impacted by this.
Sex drive doesn't equate with procreation, as we well know. Humans are definitely the most prolific in the sexual realm, but that doesn't necessarily yield more kids.
Sure.
So, and I think the developed countries have the lowest birth rate. The developing ones, the third world countries, have the highest, and therefore the highest mortality rate for children as well. So I think what we would see is just an expansion of what we do see today, where people would delay having children for perhaps centuries even.
Hundreds, yeah.
And they would have the choice. There's been a long discussion about this on the internet as well. It's like, would you, once the population gets to such a degree, then you choose to either have a child or continue living, kind of thing. And I think, once again, we have to look to individual decisions in their local areas of knowledge and rely on free market processes for people to make decisions accordingly, and things will play out as they do in any free market system. So it's interesting to speculate on, for sure.
Mm.
So let's see. We can delve into this last video titled The Internet, Where Religions Come to Die. And I think this kind of refers to what we were talking about at the beginning about how the Mormon Church is realizing that they're losing their adoption rate. You know, I think this is across the board with religions, and I believe he addresses that in here. But it is nonetheless an important, potent device by which to sort of reverse indoctrinate, you know, to just enlighten people about a different way than they've been brought up to think and believe. So here we go.
religion online gets routed. But to understand why the internet is a place where religions come to die, you need to take a broad brush look at the way that religions function as social organizations. In order for a religious population to be stable, it must propagate effectively. That is, the number who join the faith must be greater or equal to the numbers who leave it. This rate equation defines the success of all religions. Unsuccessful religions are, by definition, those that fail to propagate effectively. Likewise, if you want to be a successful religion, you must actively get others to subscribe to your faith. And this typically includes social coercion and the abuse of the manipulative minds of children. I mean, the willingness of children to accept Santa Claus testifies to the universal susceptibility of the child's mind to suggestion, especially by its parents, and its inability to accurately distinguish between a comfortable fantasy and reality. And for those of you who doubt the effect you can have on a young child's mind, even inadvertently, at the age of about 8, I was told the story of Chesterfield Church, which is the devil came down and wrapped his tail around the steeple and thus bent it, rather than it being something to do with unseasoned timber. But I remember being terrified at the concept, not particularly of the devil, but of the existence of giant monsters capable of doing this. Yes, I know it's an absolutely absurd suggestion to the mind of an adult, but to a child it was a terrifying concept. And if at that point someone had told me that praying would save me from such monsters, I would have done it simply through the fear induced by my lack of ability to accurately assess threats. In this sense, I would maintain that just give me any child of formative age, and I could get them to believe anything, simply by pushing the right psychological buttons and by telling the child the right stories.
I am the embodiment of God. I am divinity and humanity combined. And I'll say more than that. I swear it by the one who lives forever and ever that it's so.
Somehow, it was like all of heaven was open to me. Somehow, I started to see God. Well, somehow, as the Son of God holding me.
Yeah.
And so I'm laying there, and I was like, for the first time, I was like, God loves me.
Mm-hmm.
He loves me. And Michael was saying things to me like, you're accepted, you know, you're healed.
Simply by pushing the right psychological buttons.
This was God holding me.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, you know, the next day, Father sent you.
Yeah. My experience was, you know, similar to yours.
Uh-huh.
I took off my clothes and I laid naked on his bed and he just held me. And it was like a whole new picture opened up to me of God.
See, people outside say, well, you know, it's fine if you're an adult and you join a group like this because that's a choice you make. But when children are born into groups like this, they say, well, these children have not really made a choice about it. They've been born into it. And that this is the world that they know. This is the only world that they know.
Excuse them. They're laughing at you.
Now, religion, for the large part, may not be as contrived or as intentful as this, but their achievement is the same, and that's to abuse the receptive mind of the child into becoming a member of the religion. Similarly, religions need to put a great emphasis on preventing people from leaving the religion. This is typically done through social coercion.
Why do you think it is that so few people do what you have done and leave the church?
The moment you acknowledge to yourself that Joseph Smith did not tell the truth about his experiences and his achievements, you just committed social suicide.
And again, some practice the art more fervently than others. Islam, however, takes leaving the faith, that's apostasy, to a whole nother level.
What is the penalty
for apostasy?
And that is
the thing that you failed to discuss, and that's why you've got those prejudicial views about faith.
What is the penalty for apostasy? What do you teach the children will happen to them if they give up the Muslim faith?
Well, let's bring the debate back into Britain.
What is the penalty for apostasy? But what is the penalty for apostasy? What is the penalty for leaving the Muslim faith?
To be honest, I cannot back that point up.
Dr. Mukaddam, what is the penalty for apostasy?
Before
we keep coming down this apostasy, give us a quick answer on what is the penalty of apostasy. Let me come in the audience way.
You very well know if it's an Islamic country, then the Sharia is very clear. Apostasy is dealt with the death penalty.
Thank you. That's all I want to hear.
But such harsh treatment of those who leave the faith encourages the remaining to remain faithful. It instructs the remaining members that there is a horrible price to pay for even thinking about leaving the religion.
I drove away, and I fully expected, because Mormons are very good at going after their lost sheep. Okay, when someone's leaving the fold, they don't let you leave easy. They go after you. Okay.
Typically, such behavior is enhanced by the population strongly discouraging subjecting the faith to scrutiny. However, such coercive techniques are much more effective with the application of crowd psychology, that is, the local superiority of numbers.
I need you to get serious, serious with God. Say, God, I'm here to be trained. I'm here for an education.
I'm willing, God.
I'll do what you want me to do.
I'll say what you want me to say.
In Jesus' name. Amen.
The chant. Everyone loves a drumming repetitive chant.
Attention, everyone.
The leader is good.
The leader is great.
We surrender our will as of the state.
The leader is good.
The leader is great.
We surrender our will as of the state.
That is, the efficiency of indoctrination is significantly reduced when all the members are not localized in one place. It is generally the case that the more bizarre the religion, the more extreme these factors are exploited. Those who most shamelessly exploit such techniques are typically called cults.
What methods do you use?
Extortion, force, threats, duress.
But there's no real defining line. Essentially, all religions pursue such methods to a greater or lesser extent. Now, this sort of status quo has been propagating happily for thousands of years in thousands of cultures with thousands of religions. But our civilization has recently changed in two significant ways, both of which account for the reduction of religion in first world countries. Firstly, we acknowledge the susceptibility of the child's mind and view indoctrinating children as an abusive practice. Modern civilization sees activities such as threatening children, children who will happily accept the reality of a man dressed in red giving things away from a floating sleigh pulled by flying reindeer, threatening them with eternal torture by fire if they don't subscribe to you, your particular brand of faith, is seen as a particularly abusive and an unnecessarily sadistic hard sell on a vulnerable and captive audience. Secondly, is the internet. On a local level, freethinkers may be a minority compared to a specific religion, but that minority has homogeneity worldwide. The bottom line is that freethinkers could be a minority everywhere, but still a major player on the world stage. Indeed, by percent, arguably only the Catholic Church is larger than those claiming no religion. And just to put that into hard context, the Thunderfoot channel alone currently has a YouTube footprint about four times larger than the largest religious denomination in the world. Further, religions are typically introverted societies where questioning the religion or religious authority is strongly discouraged.
So, for a while I would go to church, and I wasn't trying to make trouble. I was just raising my hand and saying, you know, I read this and blah, 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 blah. And no one had any answers. And no one had any tolerance for that either. It became clear to me, and I stopped going to church at a certain point because I knew I was. They weren't there, you know. They were there to have their faith renewed and all that stuff, and I just wasn't helping.
However, on the web, it is essentially impossible to avoid such scrutiny, and this strips religion of one of its main protective mechanisms. Conversely, science in such a forum is a hands-down winner. Science was always built on ideas surviving open scrutiny, from evolution to electricity, from special relativity to superconductivity. As science is essentially dedicated to building a better understanding of the universe, it thrives on poor or incorrect understandings being expunged, and as such, it welcomes such scrutiny, as it ensures that what remains or what has been added makes it stronger and more robust than what we had before. Scrutiny advances our understanding and makes science stronger, while religion simply wilts to naught under the self-same spotlight. So is this a reason to do nothing, as smart arguments propagate better than bad ones in an open forum? Absolutely not. The reason religions fail on the internet is because people like you subject them to scrutiny. If it's not subjected to that scrutiny, if it's not put under that spotlight, it will not disintegrate. This is how it works. It's the atrophy of an unsustainable idea by a thousand cuts on a wide front that makes the internet simply a place where religions come to die.
Yeah, and I guess the same thing could be said about statism as well, huh?
I hope.
Yeah.
I have faith.
You have faith. Yes, it's in our prayers.
I'll share your enthusiasm when schoolsucksproject.com is getting more hits than mybarackobama.com.
Yeah.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, I think he hit a lot of the main points there, didn't he?
Yeah. The part where children are these open minds that are so easy to exploit with this kind of information. When you think about the natural curiosity of a child at that point in their life and how everything is why, I think there might be something attractive, even if they don't fully understand it at the time, about having all of that curiosity satiated by somebody who comes and says, do you want to understand how everything works?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, and I think when there's so much mystery and so much unknown at that age, this kind of fantasy, like others, where there's some kind of reward at the end for believing, might be very attractive.
Yeah. Punishment rewards from an early age.
No, obviously that doesn't, not to overlook the tremendous amount of indoctrination and coercion that goes into getting young people, the force that goes into getting young people to believe this stuff.
Yes.
But
without that, if parents were to take the stance of, mom and I or father and I are going to be going to church and we were brought up with this religion as children, so we're very keen on not having you experience that same sort of indoctrination. This is what we believe. We're going to go do this. You have the choice to come with us or not. And, you know, to follow that up with some logical clarity about the concepts that they're portraying in church, the notion of self-sacrifice as some sort of virtue, that you're some sort of sinner. You have original sin, which is completely in contradiction to what we know about psychology and human nature. So I think parents have to overlook a whole lot of logical insights in order to enable their children to adopt these beliefs, you know?
Yeah, and this spreads far beyond religion. We see adults who claim to be the most sure of their beliefs or always seem to be, they always seem to be the first in line to use force to get other people to accept those beliefs.
Yeah, making demands and then punishing and threatening when those demands are not fulfilled.
That's probably only because the beliefs are so important, not because there's anything.
Oh, of course, yes. The more important the belief, the more force you must use to impose it.
Right.
I mean, geez, that is the essence of religion and statism, which kind of makes me scratch my head about sites like this LDSLiberty.org. They have their own podcast, and the subtitle is Advancing the Cause of Liberty in Light of the Restored Gospel. So I wonder what they mean by restored gospel.
Well, I was going to mention earlier that one part of the Mormon church is that democracy is actually inspired by God. So, you know, that basically makes it so that in order to be a part of the Mormon church fully, and it's almost like a commandment that you've got to support government. And, you know, I have Mormon friends that anytime we talk about politics, I'm like, this is going to end bad for the discussion because they think God said democracy is what we're supposed to have.
Yeah.
Like, I'm literally saying you've got to give up God by even saying there might be another system we can live by, like maybe the non-aggression principle, where we don't have to coerce each other into doing things, you know? Mm-hmm. But really, I'm just saying, oh, I'm going to take your God.
Yeah.
Or I'm, you know, leading towards that. Oh, well, if I give up one of the things that the all-powerful, all-knowing being said, then I'm starting to lose God altogether.
Mm-hmm. It starts to unravel there. It's like you cannot contradict God or the inspired word of God. But in order to live, I mean, as Ayn Rand noted, if you're going to live as a human being, you have to smuggle in some semblance of selfishness so you don't actually die from complete self-sacrifice.
Yeah.
Right? Mental sacrifice, physical sacrifice.
Yeah.
So that's the guilt that people carry with them because they're not being completely self-sacrificial with the religious concepts.
Yeah, that video, normally I think I would feel a lot of disgust when I hear the kids just quoting stuff they've been told to say. Mm-hmm. But for whatever reason, the NVC, the nonviolent communication stuff, really welled up in me. And I was just thinking of how much empathy I have for all those people that have that, to me, you know, that, I don't even know how to say it, the thing in their mind that makes them think they have to stay connected to this non-reality.
Mm-hmm. Which helps them connect to others, supposedly. You know, it is about the connections with others that's wanting to be maintained, you know, almost in a desperate sort of way.
Yeah, it just reminds me of the whole insane asylum. All the Jesuses, they all hang out together. The Napoleons, they all hang out together.
Yes, and they argue with each other.
Like, I'm Napoleon. No, I'm Napoleon. You know, and it just, that's what religion suddenly seemed like. Well, it's just people that have been, you know, whipped into being insane, sane, what they were taught to say. And they're, anytime I get kind of, you know, vicious or want to be angry or be incredibly rude about it, sometimes that empathy really wells up in me and go, look, even if he's 67, he was indoctrinated into this.
Yes, indeed.
And my empathy just like really feels, because I know how hard it was to try and train my mind to where it is right now, even though I've got tons of work to do with logic and reason and this kind of thing. It was a hard road. So I can, in some ways, understand not wanting to, I guess, not only rock the boat and lose every, you know, possibly your friends, or in the case of obviously the Muslim community, maybe be killed, because, you know, that's against everything is to not believe. But it's, you know, there's definitely a lot of empathy to be had for that. Not sure what to do after that, but that's what I felt when I was listening to that.
Mm-hmm. If people have been chastised into some sort of belief system, it doesn't help to chastise them out of it or try to.
Yeah.
You know, it usually just emboldens their defenses and reduces the chances that they're going to be able to connect with the fear, the anxiety, the confusion that was part of their lives when they were children, trying to make sense of all this stuff, trying to decipher what's true and what's false. I mean, that's the main aspect of our rational faculty, to determine what are the facts of reality. How can I use my mind to live in this life and to flourish? And when that's circumvented with all of this dogma and mysticism, it just makes a whole lot of confusion.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I think that people who are liberty lovers that are still immersed in the religiosity are compartmentalizing the belief and sort of walling it off from all of these insights that we've been identifying on this show today. And I think eventually the evidence, the information that they'll be exposed to through things like the internet, which is a huge humanity-changing vehicle, they'll eventually break down the walls of those compartments and become integrated with the objective reality that we all experience on a daily basis.
Well, I definitely have hope.
Indeed.
As do I.
Keep the hope alive. So any other thoughts?
Oh, I think we've been pretty thorough today.
This might be the longest podcast yet on Complete Liberty Podcast.
No, I bet we've done a longer one than this.
You think so? I don't know. I think my longest one is 2 hours and 5 minutes or 10 minutes or something. But this will be up there in the list. So
sweet. My debut.
We could have gone on for another hour or two, I'm sure, but we have time constraints. But I really appreciate you guys coming on the show and sharing your insights and your stories and stuff. And I'm really grateful to have you as friends and in this journey called life and figuring things out from a logical, objective perspective that's also tied with the empathetic process, because that is really what's going to be necessary to get to that world where people are treating each other in a voluntary fashion and want to meet each other's needs and make life more wonderful, as Rosenberg would say.
Yeah, that would
thank
be
you
amazing.
Very much for including me in this series as well.
Most welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Wes. It's been an honor to finally be on.
Absolutely. Yes, you have to come on again. Absolutely. And your website is internetbusinessmastery.com.
Yes.
And Brett's is schoolsucksproject.com. And you're in the midst of revamping the website, right, Brett?
Oh, my goodness, am I?
You're up to your eyeballs and alligators, huh?
Indeed. So that's coming along. And a couple other places you could check us out are on YouTube. Our username is School Sucks Podcast. And the link that I'm pushing, schoolsucksproject.com/live, Thursdays, 10 p.m. Eastern Time. That would be much appreciated.
Excellent. All righty. Well, thanks, guys, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, Wes.
Thanks, Wes.
Everything I own, it belongs to you.